True Crime Brewery contains disturbing content related to real-life crimes. Medical information is opinion based on facts of a crime and should not be interpreted as medical advice or treatment. Listener discretion is advised.
It's extremely calculated, cold, and vicious.
You got to get Greg DeVillers out of the way so you can keep using methamphetamine. You got to get Greg DeVillers out of the way so that you can have your love affair.
Greg is lying in bed, supposedly all day. There is a phone next to his bed.
She had had some drugs, some oxycodone and some clonazepam. How is it that he ended up with oxycodone and clonazepam in his system when he never used that stuff?
She calls 911. She's standing in another room, a good 20 feet away from the body.
She's not breathing heavy. If you listen to the phone call, she never did CPR on him.
Her breathing seemed throughout that phone call like it would if somebody was just right on the phone.
Greg DeVillers was way dead.
They saw lividity. His lips were turning blue.
She made sure of it before she called 911. The death scene that she so carefully staged is all messed up.
Welcome to True Crime Brewery. I'm Jill.
And I'm Dick.
Kristen Rossum and Greg DeVillers were newlyweds who seemed to have a really bright future ahead of them. But sometimes things are not what they seem. We all know that. Beneath the surface, their relationship was poisoned by lies, addiction, and betrayal. Kristen was a toxicologist at the medical examiner's office. She may have appeared to be professional and loyal, but she was in truth a methamphetamine addict involved in a long-term sexual affair with her boss. She was also in a position with unlimited access to dangerous drugs. When her husband Greg died of a drug overdose, his family and friends pressured the police to investigate his death as a homicide. Kristen had claimed that Greg learned about her affair and killed himself. Investigators believed she killed Greg because she was afraid he was going to expose her affair as well as her drug use. Kristen Rossum was a pretty unlikely killer, but her husband's death was very suspicious. Questions about the scene and the events leading up to Greg's death showed a long history of deceit by Kristen and revealed the possibility that she and her lover plotted together to kill Greg. So come join us at the quiet end today for Heart Stopper, The Death of Greg DeVillers. It's the story of a complex murder plot fueled by drug addiction, as well as a clandestine love affair.
So we're going to drink a nice San Diego beer today. This is Sublime Mexican Lager. It's from Alesmith Brewing Company, one of my favorite brewers. And as the name implies, this is kind of a Corona-type beer. It's a Vienna lager. And it's actually quite good. It's probably what Corona wishes it could taste like.
Ooh, snap.
Snap. So it's a clear gold beer with a nice white head, a nice aroma, kind of sweet, grassy, some floral hops. Taste follows the nose perfectly. Very easy drinking beer. It's only 5% alcohol by volume. Fairly tasty. Goes well with anything. Let's go hoist a few.
Okay, let's open it up.
Okay.
It smells very summery.
It is. And, it's not like you're having the best beer in the world.
Sure.
But it's a very serviceable beer. I think it's great.
It's what my late mother-in-law would have called a lawn mowing beer. A beer you want to have after you mow the lawn.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay. Let's go on down to the quiet end.
Let's do that. It's kind of busy down there.
It is. It's a packed house today.
Yeah, well, the fact that it's like 4,000 degrees outside might factor into that decision. Everyone's sitting in the nice air conditioning.
I don't know if it's quite 4,000, but it is a hot one. And the only thing about having to come inside and drink is we don't get to bring the dogs along. So that makes me a little sad. But it's too hot to be out there, especially for our furry friends.
It is.
Yeah.
So we might as well enjoy the cool, refreshing air conditioning.
That's right. Why don't you go ahead and start this story? This is really a fascinating story. I was surprised I hadn't heard of it before.
Yeah, I know. How did we come across it?
Someone recommended it. I thought you were keeping track of who was recommending things.
You're right. Someone did recommend it.
Yeah, not that long ago.
No. but I guess I hadn't started keeping track of who recommended it.
It was just before you started keeping track.
Exactly.
Okay, so whoever recommended it, you can write in and give us your name if you want us to give you some credit.
Well, it was a great case.
It's a very good case to cover, yes.
So anyway, like you said in the introduction, Jill, Kristen Rossum was an unlikely killer. Her childhood and early teens showed promise for an exceptional future academically. Now, her parents were both very stable, well-educated people, and she was quite a gifted ballet dancer at one point. But, like they sometimes can, things fell apart, and a lot of that seemed to stem from drug use, primarily crystal meth.
That's a bad drug.
Well, it is. I mean, all we ever learned about it was from watching Breaking Bad.
Yeah.
I guess there's other sources too, but yeah, it's not portrayed in a good light, is it?
No, it's a really tough drug, which we'll get into. I mean, a lot of illicit drugs are bad, of course, but this one seems to be one of the worst, and it really ravaged this young woman's life and many of the people around her as a result.
Well, it's not going to treat you well.
No.
If you're addicted to it.
Absolutely not.
And I think it eats away at your brain.
I think it does. I mean, there is some research on that.
So Kristen was the oldest child of two very accomplished parents. And she is probably raised with a certain amount of pressure to succeed. At an early age, her parents taught her the importance of appearances. And I'm sure that contributed to the perfectionism that haunted her throughout her life. There's no question she wanted to be perfect. Now, whether it's true or not, she did feel that it was expected of her. And for the most part, she excelled at everything she did, at least as a child. Unfortunately, you get older, and you're not able to be perfect. You're not able to be perfect any longer.
Well, the competition sure gets more difficult, doesn't it?
Doesn't it, though?
And being a teen girl is no trip to Hollywood. Like many teen girls, Kristen had an inner voice that criticized her appearance when she looked in the mirror. And it's possible that her need to be perfect was so overwhelming at times that getting high on drugs was her only escape from it. One friend said that Kristen's addiction to methamphetamine may have been the only thing that she felt she had control over. But addiction eventually takes over and controls the addict. And people high on meth aren't thinking or acting reasonably.
Kristen was born in October 1976 in Memphis, Tennessee. Her father was a political science professor, and her mother did marketing research. Kristen's baby brother, Brent, was born about 3 years later, and Pierce, the younger of her two brothers, was born 4 years after that, so three-kid family.
Yep.
And these are, like you said, pretty intelligent, upwardly mobile parents.
Oh, absolutely, yes.
So there's a lot of moving.
There was a lot of moving early on as the careers of her parents progressed. While Kristen and her brothers were growing up, they moved around the country. And when Kristen was about 5, they moved to Wilmette, which is a suburb of Chicago. And there they were able to spend time with her extended family. So this was a pretty good period of time for her. She and her mother would take the train into the city and go Christmas shopping at Marshall Fields or go see a play. So that sounds like a pretty good childhood right there. But the focus on her looks started when she was really little. When she was 4, her parents arranged for Kristen to have a commercial headshot taken. She was a pretty, petite, little blonde girl, and she worked as a model for Marshall Fields, Sears, and Montgomery Ward. She was pretty much a natural at posing and smiling for the camera, but then she gave up modeling for ballet when her family moved to Bethesda, Maryland. Her father accepted a position as deputy director of the Bureau of Justice Statistics there, so that was a really good job, obviously.
Oh, it certainly was. I was just wondering, though, when she was 4, this certainly wasn't her idea that she wanted to be a model when she was 4.
Well, that's a whole topic we could spend an hour on.
Well, we've talked about that with JonBenet Ramsey.
Yeah, I think the parents have some place in that.
Exactly.
But, I mean, she could have been shown that kind of thing with other kids and decided that's what she wanted to do. She was kind of the typical little blonde. It's a lot like JonBenet. But these aren't Southerners.
No.
No.
Now, when she was 6, Kristen began training at the Maryland Youth Ballet Academy, and she very quickly became a talented young dancer. She actually was chosen for a walk-on role in a performance of Romeo and Juliet at the Kennedy Center in Washington, D.C. And also around that same time, she began to discover a love of science. Then in June 1985, the family moved to Claremont, California. And this is a small town of primarily Caucasian, highly educated residents. And in the years to come, this community was the family's base. In 2000, it had a population of 34,000 and a median income of about 70,000. About 5,000 students and professors associated with the 8 institutions of higher learning lived in the area. And Kristen's parents passed on a strong work ethic to their children and encouraged them in academic pursuits.
Well, yeah, if your parents are PhDs, you just naturally have that pressure.
Well, sure.
And they mean well, I think, when you're trying to get your kids to be educated. That's not a bad thing, but there can be a lot of pressure. But unlike his children, Ralph Rossum didn't grow up with parents with such academic drive or the money to pay for that kind of education. He was raised on a small dairy farm, and Ralph was the only member of his extended family to graduate from college. So sometimes these can be the ones that give the most pressure, the ones that are the first to do it in their family and come from more humble roots.
Yeah, it's like they're born again or something.
Yes. It's like the ex-smoker who just gets really mad at smokers.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, Kristen's mother, Constance, who was raised in Indiana, studied radio and television journalism as an undergrad and journalism again in graduate school. And with her background, Constance was able to succeed both in academia and business, starting her own consulting firm. By the time Kristen was 9 or 10, she was taking dance seriously. She split her after-school time between ballet and doing homework, and she earned straight A's. Her perfectionism also influenced her dancing, of course, and she seemed to have a passion for it. But I really haven't met a lot of ballet dancers who aren't perfectionists. That kind of comes with the territory, doesn't it?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, that might be painting them with a broad brush, but that's certainly the impression.
Yeah, it's very competitive. You have to be very slender, and you have to be very good at what you're doing.
Exactly.
But she was popular in high school. Her fellow students thought that she always seemed to be smiling and was kind. In 1991, Kristen auditioned for a spot in a summer program with the Boston Ballet, and she got it. So she got to spend the summer there. Then that fall, Ralph took a job as president of Hampton-Sydney College in Southern Virginia. So Kristen enrolled at a boarding school for girls that was about 60 miles away so she could dance with a troupe there in Richmond. But then she had a bad fall that year when a fellow dancer dropped her. She tore several ligaments and had to wear a cast for nearly 2 months. She re-injured her leg a few months later and developed a stress fracture that just wouldn't heal. So she got frustrated and she quit dancing.
Well, an injury like that is going to be pretty severe anyway.
And it's hard to come back and be a dancer with that.
Yeah, I mean, in the sense that you're on the shelf for a while. And even when your cast is off, you're still not fully active.
Well, no, you're kind of starting over because being a ballet dancer, you have to have those calluses on your feet to be able to get right up on your toes. There's a lot to it that you just kind of have to start from scratch in a way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I can see her frustration.
Yeah, sure.
So about this time, Kristen began experimenting with drugs and alcohol. And if that wasn't enough, she also started smoking cigarettes. So Kristen's brothers noticed that she was sad and acting strangely. She was very restless and stayed up late at night. One of her brothers found a pipe and a small mirror in the house and showed them to Constance. Now, Constance didn't know much about drugs, really nothing about drugs, but she knew enough to be worried.
Well, here's the thing. Sure, she might not have had street smarts, but you're smart enough that you can look at these things and say, this looks like serious drug paraphernalia. I should at least find out more about it. And this family had a pretty strong sense of denial. So even though they might have been worried, they weren't really going to go head on with this problem. They wanted to forget about it.
Right. We'll ignore it. It'll go away.
Sure. And I mean, I've been there to a certain extent, but these people were really good at it.
You know, Kristen had always excelled in school. So when she started to turn her homework in late and her grades were slipping, her parents knew something was wrong. And things got worse and her parents grew more and more anxious. Now, Kristen's parents thought that they knew her friends, but they didn't know that Kristen was becoming involved with a new group that liked to party. And she was introduced to snorting crystal meth at one of these parties. Now, this certainly wasn't socially acceptable with most of the kids at school. So she started buying it on her own and using it in her bedroom. She used it more and more frequently, progressed to smoking it also. And soon she was spending less time with her friends, more time with her meth, and things are just spiraling downhill. She's losing weight, her grades are dropping, things aren't going well.
No, and I think this is right there on the level of smoking crack, wouldn't you say?
Yep.
So it's pretty bad. In 1993, while Ralph and Constance went on an anniversary cruise to the Caribbean, Kristen threw a surprise birthday party for her little brother Pierce on St. Paddy's Day. Older kids started showing up, though, with alcohol. And we don't know how much Kristen knew about this, that this was going to happen. But she did let a group of girlfriends stay over. And sometime during that week, her meth dealer came by the house with some friends. A couple of weeks after her parents returned from their cruise, they learned that some of their credit cards, some personal checks, and also a new video camera were missing. So they called the police and reported a burglary. This is how naive they were. They didn't say, "Hey, Kristen, we were gone last week. Where's our stuff?"
Right.
Which kind of, if you have a teenager, that should be the first thing you check. But Constance also found a suspicious package of white powder in their mailbox. So she did ask Kristen about that, and Kristen said she had no idea where it came from. So Constance just turned it over to the police as if it wasn't related to her family at all, even though it was in their mailbox. But Kristen herself, she knew she had a problem. Meth had become a necessity for her on a daily basis. She needed it just to feel okay and functional. So tell me a little bit about methamphetamine, besides what we know from Breaking Bad.
Okay. Well, we know that it's a psychostimulant, like amphetamine and cocaine. Methamphetamine and cocaine are structurally different, but both can result in an accumulation of dopamine, which is a neurotransmitter in the brain, and it can produce an unnatural level of euphoria. So the problem, though, is while cocaine is quickly metabolized by the body, methamphetamine can stay in the system for about 10 to 12 times longer, and it can produce a high that lasts from 8 to 24 hours, compared to 20 to 30 minutes with cocaine. Now, with small doses, methamphetamine can decrease the appetite and keep you awake for quite some time.
Well, and decreasing the appetite is something most teen girls really like.
Yeah, that's kind of drastic to do it that way.
Well, sure, but I mean that would be a side effect of it that she would enjoy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Higher doses can cause convulsions. It can be inhaled, smoked, snorted, or injected. Chronic users can have episodes of violent behavior, anxiety, confusion, insomnia, hallucinations, delusions, and paranoia, all of which can result in homicidal and suicidal thoughts. And even after you stop using meth, if you've been a heavy user, these psychoses can persist for months, maybe even years, after stoppage of the drug.
So it's actually like a permanent brain damage it can cause?
Exactly.
Wow.
And one other kind of side effect is the continued use of methamphetamine can also heighten the desire for increasingly high levels of sexual stimulation.
Which might account for why someone would have sex outside of marriage.
I think it could account for why someone would have a lover and maybe a couple other bedmates at the same time. Sure.
Well, Kristen's parents began to realize that their daughter was the one who had stolen those credit cards and checks, and that she used the money to buy drugs. One day, Ralph found white powder in Kristen's backpack, and he confronted her. There was a kind of a tiff there, of course, and she locked herself in the bathroom and started making superficial cuts on her wrists with a razor blade. Her parents decided that she didn't need to go to the hospital and tried to handle the situation on their own. So I think that was a big mistake.
Well, it certainly was in hindsight, wasn't it?
If not the hospital, which I definitely think she should have gone to the hospital and been triaged, but she should have been in therapy and possibly in a rehab center for a while.
Definitely.
But, you know, they were kind of preoccupied with appearances. So they had her graduate early from high school and they enrolled her at a college where Ralph was a professor. So for a while, this seemed to work and kind of keep her in line. Her parents were keeping an eye on her all the time, and she was doing well in school, so they thought they'd gotten her away from the bad influences. But, you know, that didn't last. Kristen met another student who was a meth user, and that friend offered her some at a party, and she took it. But, of course, it left her wanting more. So her need for meth grew stronger, and things began to snowball. Soon Kristen was using every day again, and as Christmas vacation approached, she realized she couldn't let her parents see her because she'd been on a binge. She looked really bad. She was skinny and strung out. She hadn't slept for days.
Yeah, and she also liked to pick at herself.
Yeah, that's something that people addicted to meth do. They feel like itchy, buggy things on their skin.
Yeah.
So she had scabs on her arms and face.
Scabs all over. Well, maybe not all over the place, but a lot of scabs.
Right. Yep. She did. So she pretty much decided to run away, at least for a while.
Yeah, short-term solution, huh?
Yeah. Well, she's not thinking long-term here.
No.
No. So she took an Amtrak train to San Diego and continued south. At the first trolley stop in Chula Vista, she rented a hotel room. She'd heard that Tijuana, the first town across the border into Mexico, was a fun place for college students to meet up and party. So she got back on the trolley the next morning and took it to San Ysidro, the last stop on the U.S. side of the border. Then she followed the signs to the pedestrian crossing, and she joined a group of people who were walking over the bridge and heading into Mexico, mostly young people.
Sure, we're going to go party.
Yep.
Now, it just happened that same evening that Greg DeVillers, his brothers Jerome and Bertrand, and a friend Aaron Wallow were walking across the bridge. Like I said, this is the same time that Kristen was going over.
Mm-hmm.
So their trip was to be a rite of passage for Bertrand, who had come down from Palm Springs to visit. So he was having a birthday, I think. Or is it just time to do it? Anyway,
I think he was having a birthday.
They're going to head over the border and we're going to have a great time.
Yes.
So by the time the DeVillers crew was walking to the border crossing, it was dark. Kristen was walking sideways near the turnstile, and she bumped into Greg. She dropped her jacket, and they both went to pick it up, and then they started talking. Since she was alone, she was relieved to walk with his group, and she thought Greg looked like a really nice guy, and it was obvious that he was attracted to her. So they all hop in a cab, once they're over in Tijuana, and they asked to be dropped off on a street which was lined with bars and dance clubs. Now, for some Americans, Tijuana is a place to stock up on prescription drugs, which are cheaper and easier to get there. And you don't need a prescription like you do in the U.S. Pretty much as easy as walking into a pharmacy and asking the clerk behind the counter for a drug of choice. So Kristen would take advantage of this several times over the years, buying muscle relaxants, diet pills, and even narcotics.
So Kristen and the DeVillers group went to several bars that night. They had tequila shots and beers, and Greg and Kristen started acting like a couple within a couple of hours. Between midnight and 2 a.m., the group walked back over the pedestrian bridge to San Ysidro and to their car. Greg invited Kristen to stay with him at the two-bedroom apartment that he shared with his brother and his friend. So Kristen felt safe with Greg, and she accepted that offer. She definitely didn't want to go home to her parents. Greg and Kristen shared the same bed, and they had sex that same night. And then she decided to stay on there. Kristen's parents checked in with her teachers and learned that she'd missed all of her final exams. When she hadn't turned up by the day after Christmas, they were pretty frantic, and they filed a missing persons report with the campus police.
Yeah, can you imagine? They go to pick her up. They haven't seen her for most of the semester while she's been away at school. As far as they know, school's going well.
Well, they were checking in with her, and they thought it was going well.
Yeah, but they hadn't seen her, so they go to pick her up, and she's gone? Wow.
I know. I'd just be terrified that she'd been murdered.
Yeah, no kidding.
So in early January, just, I don't know, a week or so later, Kristen sent her parents a letter, and she said she was sorry for running away like she did. But the letter had no return address or phone number. But they did see that it had a San Diego postmark, so they knew she was nearby. Soon afterwards, she called her parents, and Kristen said she'd been staying with some nice people in San Diego. She hadn't wanted to call until she was ready to prove that she was serious about getting off of the drugs. So if the family wanted to see her, she said that she did want to come home for a visit. So Greg had kind of straightened her out for a while. Being with Greg was a good thing for her.
Well, he put some stability into her life.
Yeah.
And he was not just anti-drug, but anti-tobacco, anti-alcohol.
Well, not totally anti-alcohol. He did go out with his friends and have some drinks, but I mean, he wasn't a partier.
Yeah. No, he wasn't. So Kristen told her mom that she had had three jobs and she was trying to turn her life around. She borrowed Greg's car and drove up to Claremont on a Sunday to see her family and to collect some of her things. Over a tearful lunch, Kristen shared how she'd driven up in the car that her friend Greg DeVillers had loaned her. She told her family she's teaching ballet classes and working at a restaurant, and that she had also taken a third job at California Pizza Kitchen. Now, it seemed important to her that her family believed she was getting better. The Rossums, for their part, began to believe that Greg was their daughter's savior. Well, sure. She starts dating him, and she's turned things around.
Yeah.
Apparently.
He was a nice guy.
He was. Now, they certainly weren't thrilled when they first learned that Kristen and Greg were living together, but they decided it was worth it if she's getting her life together and staying off of drugs. But there were problems at Greg's apartment. Remember, it's a two-bedroom place, right?
Yes.
So Greg's brother Jerome was being forced to share his bedroom, but the rent was still being divided by only three people. Then Greg started letting Kristen drive to work in the car that he and Greg had been sharing. Now then some of Greg's jewelry went missing from their bedroom. Greg blamed Jerome's friends for taking it, but Jerome said it was more likely Kristen who had stolen it.
Yeah, well, Greg wouldn't hear of that because he loved her already.
Right.
About a week after Greg's jewelry had disappeared, the roommate said that some of his personal checks were missing, and Greg admitted that Kristen had taken them because he'd found out. And what he'd done is he'd torn them up so she couldn't use them, and she'd apologized. But, you know, that's something to worry about if you start seeing someone and they steal checks.
Don't you think?
I think so.
Well, particularly a drug abuser. I don't know how much they knew of her drug use.
Yeah, I'm not sure how much he knew in the beginning. But, you know, he was head over heels.
Yeah.
And she was charming. That summer, Greg told Kristen's father that he wanted to marry her. Because Greg was really this guy who wanted to be the caretaker. And we'll get into that when we talk a little bit about his background. So he liked being Kristen's savior. But Ralph told Greg he needed to finish college before he could marry Kristen. So Greg and Kristen decided they would get engaged. But as much as the Rossums didn't approve of the couple living together, they did decide to accept that because Greg was really kind, and they could definitely tell that he cared about their daughter. And he was strongly opposed to drug use, so that seemed to keep her out of trouble. I think here's a good point to learn a little bit about Greg and his upbringing and his family.
Yeah, we'll see where he's coming from a little bit.
Yeah, he'd been raised in a well-educated family in the suburbs as well, but Greg's family life taught him to be a protector and a caretaker. He was the oldest son in a single-parent home, so he took on a lot of responsibility. When Greg met Kristen in 1994, she was 18 and addicted to crystal meth. At 21, with very little experience with girlfriends, Craig decided he was going to help her get off drugs. That was kind of his mission. Greg and his brothers grew up in Southern California. France was their parents' native country. Their mom, Marie France, was born in a small town near the Pyrenees. Marie France was in her 20s and worked as a physical therapist when she met Greg's father, Yves, in Mende, a town in the south of France. Yves had studied medicine at the university in Marseille. He trained in surgery and anesthesiology. Yves and Marie moved to the Chicago area in 1970 so he could continue his medical studies, and that's where they got married. Greg was born the following year. Yves did a residency in hand surgery and plastic surgery, and in 1974, he opened a surgical practice in Monte Carlo. The family moved to California, where they bought a condo, and Yves opened a second plastic surgery practice. So over the years, he traveled back and forth between his practices, and this wasn't good for the marriage or family life.
No, it certainly wasn't, although he probably was making some money, don't you think?
He probably was, but he wasn't very generous with it with his family.
No, he was basically a shit.
Yeah, he was surprisingly stingy, and the marriage ended up failing ultimately.
Yeah, Yves filed for divorce when Greg was 8, leaving Marie-France with 3 young boys. Marie-France had asthma and was a smoker. Not a good combination.
No.
She ended up with lung disease and actually became quite dependent on Greg. And his father didn't support his family as he should have or could have, and they struggled financially. So as an adult, Greg just didn't get along with his father, and they eventually became estranged. His father had promised to pay for his college expenses, but he hadn't followed through. Greg dropped out of school, started working for Rush Legal Services. This was a firm that offered copying, researching, process serving, notary, delivery, and other business services. He returned to college in the fall of 1995, which is about 9 months after meeting Kristen. By the following summer, his grades began to improve, and by the winter quarter of 97, he was earning all A's and B's. In his last quarter before graduation, in 1997, he brought his grade point average up to a 3.85.
And I think Kristen's parents had a bit of a hand in this, kind of supporting him. They wanted him to become educated.
Yeah, there's no question that they were behind him.
They were. And it's really, he wasn't used to having parents that supported him and encouraged him. So they were pretty good to him, at least in the beginning.
Yeah, no, he did a lot of this himself. I mean, his GPA was around 2.
Oh, yeah. I mean, he definitely did it himself.
And he got it up to a 3.85. That's pretty damn good.
Oh, it is. Yeah. But I think that he had a pretty good relationship with Kristen's parents, and they were kind of like surrogate parents for a while. So Kristen and Greg spent time with Marie DeVillers and went on camping trips with his brothers, Jerome and Bertrand. Kristen often took Greg to her parents' house, where he would play video games with her youngest brother, Pierce, or he would golf with Pierce and the other brother, Brent. And they often stayed for dinner with Kristen's parents. The Rossums invited Greg and Marie to their house for Thanksgiving, and they started to bring along his brothers, too, after a while. So everyone seemed to get along. And once she got clean, Kristen was able to focus on her schoolwork. She started off slowly, taking only 2 courses in the fall of 95, while she worked with Greg at Rush Legal. And on her application to the medical examiner's office 2 years later, she would stretch out the time that she worked at Rush, claiming that she'd started in 94 and had worked as an assistant office manager up through December of 1995. By the spring of 96, she was taking a full course load, and she impressed her chemistry professors as being one of their best and brightest students. She was meticulous and she was thorough. She studied forensics, which included how to identify mysterious white powders at crime scenes. This wasn't an uncommon sight at crime scenes in San Diego County at the time, because the region was known at this time as the meth capital of the world.
Now, Kristen earned her bachelor's degree with a distinction in chemistry in December of 1999, and her transcript showed a grade point average of 3.83. Now, this would have been lower, but she lied on her applications and left out classes that she had failed while she was into drug use. Greg's grades weren't as good as Kristen's, and despite bringing his GPA up to 3.85 his last semester, his overall GPA was 2.47.
A little abysmal.
But again, he worked hard and made a big correction.
That's right. And if you graduate, I give you credit. He finished.
Exactly. The Rossums took him and Kristen out for dinner to celebrate when he graduated. In the weeks after, Greg spent hours talking with the Rossums about his career options. They actually saw themselves as surrogate parents to Greg. So he got a job as a lab assistant at a pharmaceutical drug research firm called Biophysica. Greg told Constance that he found the lab environment boring and smelly. He wanted to work outdoors, and Constance told him to follow his heart. So Greg applied for a position with the California Department of Fish and Game in the summer of 1997. 5 months later, however, he received a notice that he had failed the qualifying exam. Then in August of 1998, Greg was hired by BD Farmington, a company with 400 employees. He started as an administrative assistant to the vice president of research and development. He was driven, intelligent, and organized. He was promoted to a position where he issued licenses for medical research products the company developed and sold. Greg was well-liked by his co-workers, and they looked at him as a nice, low-key, friendly guy.
So in June of 97, Kristen answered an ad for a student worker in the county medical examiner's office toxicology lab. Kristen interviewed with the supervising toxicologist, and he had started working there 29 years earlier, so he'd been there a while. His name was Barnhart. He testified in court many times to validate his lab's test results, and he was also pretty much a methamphetamine expert. But since the office didn't run any type of background check on applicants at the time, he didn't ask Kristen about her drug history. If he'd known about it, he would say later, he would not have hired her. Forensic toxicologists' jobs really revolve around drugs, including those that cause death. While Kristen worked at the medical examiner's office, the lab shelves were filled with bottles and vials, known as drug standards, which were purchased in a synthetic form for testing purposes. She and the other employees also had access to illegal street drugs that the medical examiner's investigators impounded from death scenes, and they would keep them to help identify the cause of death in particular cases. The investigators often collected prescription drug vials and bags of unidentified white powder, which in San Diego usually turned out to be methamphetamine or cocaine, one or the other.
Now, I know they didn't run any background check on applicants, but if we're in the midst of a meth epidemic, wouldn't it seem like you'd ask your applicants about prior drug use?
Sure it would. I think part of the problem is she didn't look like the type.
Yeah, that's true, I guess.
I think when she started working there, she probably wasn't using.
No, that came later.
Right.
So, okay.
Yeah.
I guess you're going to be a cynic again and say, here's a good-looking, blonde, Caucasian woman.
Sure.
She can't possibly be drug using.
Well, and I hope that's changed by now, that they're not doing that, but I could certainly see that happening.
Yeah, when I think about it, you're right.
Especially if she wasn't looking strung out at the time. Besides, we know she wasn't above lying about it anyway.
I know.
Yeah. So the easiest point of access was where drugs were emptied into a large plastic bag, and then they were moved to the toxicology lab's balance room, which was left open during the day. Now, the room was locked at night, but all of the toxicologists knew where the keys were kept, and the office had no electronic system to monitor employees' comings and goings. Eventually, the envelopes were transferred to lockers, and from there, the controlled narcotics were removed and sent to the sheriff's department to be destroyed.
Yeah, but still, I mean, this must have been like a drug abuser's paradise, right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, the proverbial kid in a candy store, right?
Right. A smorgasbord.
I mean, I almost feel sorry for her, and how did she control herself? Well, she didn't.
Right.
Right. But Barnhart was really impressed by Kristen's resume. It wasn't just that she was attractive. She had a good resume. And her college transcript showed that she'd taken many chemistry courses that were pretty tough and done really well in them. So he recommended that she be hired, and she did get the job. Of all the interns Barnhart had worked with over the years, Kristen turned out to be his favorite. As Greg and Kristen made their wedding plans, Kristen did continue to see other men, though. It's like she just couldn't help herself, almost, you know? She also expressed doubt about whether she wanted to go through with the marriage to Greg. She said this to friends and to her mom. She told her mom she couldn't decide whether Greg was the right man for her. But he'd helped her so much over the years, getting her off of drugs and supporting her, that she felt obligated to him. She did love him, she said, but she wasn't sure that she felt passionately about him, like you should if you're going to marry someone. But on the other hand, Greg adored her and wanted to be with her all the time, almost to the point where she was feeling suffocated. She didn't seem to have any time to have her own friends or do anything without him.
Yeah, you know, it's probably not a good idea to go through with a marriage because of a sense of obligation.
No, and her mother should have known that, if Kristen didn't.
Yep, but I think her parents were still looking at Greg as being the savior to Kristen, and so they obviously would want the marriage to go forward.
Well, yeah, plus they had gotten close to him.
Yeah, they
liked
him.
He was like part of the family.
So ultimately, she did go through with the wedding. And over the next several months, Kristen and Greg seemed pretty happy. As a wedding gift, Greg's family paid for their honeymoon. They began to discuss having a baby.
But in January 2000, Kristen started complaining to her mom that Greg was getting very clingy and controlling and that she felt like she was living her life in a cage. One night when her parents came down to San Diego to visit, Kristen showed up alone, saying that she left Greg at home in bed because he wasn't feeling well. So at one point, Kristen said that Greg was wondering if he might have chronic fatigue syndrome. But he never mentioned anything to his own family, and they thought he was very healthy. So to me, if you were looking back at this knowing how things turn out, you might wonder, was Kristen drugging Greg to just kind of keep him out of her way?
Well, in hindsight,
right,
which is always quite good, yeah, that's not an unlikely event.
Yeah. I mean, I wouldn't put her above doing that. And if she feels like he's kind of controlling her and she has all this access to drugs and all of a sudden he's feeling chronically fatigued, that would really perk up my ears.
Yes, it would.
So I'd just like to take a moment here to tell our listeners about earbuds and headphones by Tweaked Audio. Tweaked headphones come mic'd and unmic'd in 8 different styles and 6 different colors. Their noise-reducing design makes your podcasts, audiobooks, and music sound crystal clear. And now Tweaked is offering 33% off for our True Crime Brewery listeners. Just visit tweakedaudio.com with discount code TCB to get yours.
That's a great discount.
Yeah, I really love them.
So in March of 2000, a handsome Australian toxicologist named Michael Robertson started working as the medical examiner's lab manager. Now, there was an immediate attraction between Kristen and her boss. He was married in his early 30s with a PhD and a very impressive resume. Kristen wrote in her diary that when she and Michael made eye contact, her legs got weak and her stomach was full of butterflies. Oh, yuck.
Yeah, I know. I think she actually worded it as tummy, which is even worse.
Yes, it is.
But it's a bad sign for Greg.
Yeah, this isn't going to end well, is it?
No. None of our stories do. Haven't you caught on to that yet?
Yeah, I'm beginning to.
Okay.
So Michael had been a forensic toxicologist at National Medical Services in Pennsylvania since April of 96. He had testified as an expert witness in several court cases. He earned his doctorate in forensic medicine at Monash University in Melbourne in 1996. Where he studied pharmacology and biochemistry on a graduate scholarship. When he applied to San Diego in 1999, his resume listed 15 published articles.
And it wasn't long before Michael was spending a lot of time in Kristen's workspace, and she in his office. Co-workers also noticed that Michael and Kristen were standing unusually close to one another, often brushing hands as they passed by each other.
Pretty subtle. No one would ever catch on to the fact that they might be having an affair.
No, how could you? But the toxicologists who worked with them were really starting to talk. It was obvious. The close relationship between Michael and Kristen was causing some resentment as well. It seemed that most of his attention was focused on Kristen and her projects that she was working on. Meanwhile, Kristen was writing in her diary about him. And she wrote that she never imagined she would develop such deep feelings for a married man, especially so soon after she had gotten married herself. She wasn't getting what she needed emotionally from Greg, she wrote, and Michael felt the same way about his relationship with his wife, Nicole. So Kristen and Michael quickly began sharing their feelings and their dreams with each other. They soon realized they were both in marriages with partners who didn't share their goals or interests. And Kristen described Michael as witty, charming, intelligent, and very handsome, saying she admired him as well as his professional accomplishments. And this made her excited to go to work. She couldn't wait to get there in the morning and see him.
Michael already had a history of extramarital flirtations and at least one affair that people knew of. Now, in May of 2000, he and Kristen attended a state toxicologist conference together in Hollywood. They shared a room at the Holiday Inn. And after the conference, Michael and Kristen continued to express their feelings for each other in greeting cards, letters, and emails. Both said they'd never felt this way about anyone else, repeatedly using words like always, forever, destiny, and fate.
Yeah, this was a very dramatic love affair. And they also talked about getting married to each other, having a family, and even growing old together. They often left the office for lunch together, and at least once they both returned with wet hair, like they'd showered. So there's something that might make you a little suspicious.
Yes, maybe.
One day they were gone for 90 minutes, and Kristen was seen eating lunch in the coffee room after she'd gotten back.
So I guess she didn't eat lunch on her lunch break.
No, doesn't seem that way. So this romance had to be pretty obvious to their coworkers. Let's be real here. And they did confront Michael about their conduct that Thursday. Other toxicologists were complaining that Michael was having an inappropriate relationship with their newest and youngest colleague. But Michael denied that anything was going on. But then he sent an email to Kristen right after the meeting where he was warned, and he warned Kristen. He suggested that she delete all of his emails as soon as she read them. And after being confronted, they stopped going to lunch together in the same car. But their coworkers still noticed that they were going to lunch at the same time and leaving and returning within 5 or 10 minutes of each other. So they really weren't fooling anyone. So throughout that whole summer, Michael and Kristen met after work at a place just blocks from each of their apartments. Kristen invented a secret game of treasure hunt in the office, where they would leave hidden gifts for each other and then send directions by email to go find them. Isn't that cute?
It is.
Greg found one of Michael's love letters in the apartment, though, in June or July, and he made Kristen give him Michael's home phone number. And he went ahead and called Michael around 10 o'clock that night. Michael and his wife Nicole were in bed when the phone rang, and Michael picked it up. But of course Nicole could hear Greg shouting into the receiver, so she knew something was up. So Greg had yelled at Michael, "Stay the hell away from my wife." Michael had told his wife that he was attracted to someone in the office. But even after that phone call, he said the same story that Kristen was saying to Greg, that the two of them were having an emotional relationship, but they hadn't been physically involved at all.
Now, in October, Kristen and Michael went to a conference in Milwaukee. They each submitted travel requests to the office administrator with the estimated cost of their trip. Now, they planned to leave San Diego on Saturday, September 30th, which was 2 days before the conference started, and they were going to return from Milwaukee on Saturday, October 7th, which was the day after it ended. Michael got asked again, was he involved with Kristen physically? But again, he denied it. And they went off to the conference and had a wonderful time.
But it was kind of unusual to bring her to the conference. She wasn't very high up.
No, she wasn't. And she actually presented a paper that supposedly was written by her.
Yeah.
But wasn't.
He had written it for her, they believe.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it was a disaster, the presentation was.
Because she couldn't answer any questions about it.
She didn't know what she was doing.
Yeah, right. Then on Monday, November 6th of 2000, Greg DeVillers didn't show up for work. Greg was never late, and when he was, he would have called to let his supervisor, Stefan Grunewald, know. He never missed a day of work without calling. So when Greg still hadn't shown up by 11 o'clock, his office manager, Terry Wong, was getting concerned. He was 3 hours late without calling, so this was totally unlike Greg. Wong tried reaching him at his apartment around 11:15, but got no answer, and the phone just rang and rang. So Wong and Grunewald shared their concerns a few hours later, and they tried calling Greg again, but there was still no answer. Now, one thing they noted was that Greg hadn't been feeling well the week before. The past Monday morning, he came to the office feeling sick and told a coworker he'd thrown up after he only had a couple of beers that weekend. He also seemed agitated all week, especially that past Friday. So what do you think about that? Those things kind of are red flags to me.
Well, again, you're talking about a similar event to when Kristen showed up for dinner with her parents without Greg, saying that he's ill.
Yeah.
He thinks he has chronic fatigue. And when you look back in hindsight, he was probably being dosed with something.
It sure sounds like it, doesn't it?
Yeah.
And he knew that things were going badly, so he was agitated about it.
He certainly was. Now, around 5:30 that evening, Wong and Grunewald tried calling Greg again on the speakerphone. Still no answer. Then Wong tried once more around 7, just before leaving the office. Now, this time, Kristen answered. Wong asked to speak to Greg, but Kristen said he was sleeping. He asked her if everything was all right because Greg hadn't come to work that day. Now, Kristen said she'd phoned the office that morning and left a message saying Greg wasn't feeling well and wouldn't be coming in. She apologized if no one had received the message. And she then thanked him for calling and hung up. She seemed pretty distant. She seemed like she wanted to get off the phone pretty quickly.
Yeah, he had a weird feeling about it right from the get-go.
Yeah, Wong wondered why she wouldn't let him talk to Greg. And if Greg had been home all day, why hadn't he picked up the phone?
Yeah, even if you're home sick, if you have a phone sitting right next to you on the nightstand and it's ringing all day, at some point you're going to be awake and pick it up.
Exactly.
So that's going to lead us all to believe that he was heavily drugged. And we know that's something he wouldn't have done on his own. Everyone that knew him would say that, other than Kristen.
Exactly. So Stefan Grunewald called Greg's apartment once more that evening, which was around 9:30. And Kristen answered on the first ring. She was crying, and Grunewald could hardly understand what she was saying. The gist was that Greg isn't feeling well. The ambulance is here. I can't talk. I'll call you back. Boom.
Yeah, wow, huh? So something's up there.
So something's going on. Grunewald waited until 1 in the morning to hear back from Kristen. He finally gave up and went to bed. The call to 911 had come at 9:23 p.m. from Kristen and Greg's home. Young male down, not breathing, no pulse.
Yeah, my husband's not breathing is what she told the dispatcher. And the university dispatcher transferred her to the city of San Diego's fire medical dispatcher. And that person stayed on the phone with her until the paramedics were inside her apartment, giving her instructions on how to do CPR. And that would be something that would come back to haunt Kristen because when you listen to the 911 call, it really doesn't sound like she's putting the phone down and doing anything physically, like chest compressions or breaths. It was very suspicious.
It was.
So paramedics carried their gear up to the stairs to that second floor apartment where Kristen and Greg lived. And Kristen, though, was standing in the living room, which was quite a ways away from Greg's body that was in the bedroom. She was crying and talking to the dispatcher on the cordless phone, and she just kind of pointed and motioned the paramedics to the bedroom, where Greg was lying there alone on the floor, flat on his back. You just don't do that if you love someone, and they're not breathing. Come on. That's just terrible. He was laying between the unmade queen-size bed and a chest of drawers, unattended, while she's on the phone.
Right. And it was quite a scene that the paramedics found.
Absolutely.
So Greg's in pajama bottoms and a t-shirt. Skin was pale, lips were blue. There were rose petals scattered on the carpet around his upper body. And there was an unframed wedding photo of the couple that had been propped up against the base of the bureau. Picture looked like both people were happy.
Well, looks like your typical young, pretty couple.
Right.
Yeah.
The photo got moved to the top of the chest on Greg's right side next to a blue plastic cup of clear, odorless liquid that looked like water. There was an open bottle of aspirin that contained about a quarter of its original 200 tablets, and that was on another bureau. There's also a yellow cup, which also contained a clear, odorless liquid, resting on a nightstand on the opposite side of the bed.
So I think one big mistake here that the police made is nobody ever tested the liquid in those two cups. But paramedics, of course, wondered why there were red rose petals all over the floor. And this wasn't that long after the movie American Beauty came out, so this made everyone think of that. You know, Kevin Spacey with the rose petals.
Right.
So Greg had no pulse. He felt warm to the touch as if he'd died fairly recently. But there were no signs of what drugs he might have taken. There were no prescription pill vials, no syringes, no sign of illegal drug use, and nothing really looked out of place. Also, there was no suicide note. They asked Kristen if her husband had any medical problems or was taking any medications. And she said no, but then she did bring out a bottle of Vicodin from the bathroom at one point.
You know, the rescue team, since he felt warmed to touch still, they made every effort to bring back Greg. He was intubated and given ventilation with bag and mask. The heart monitor showed no rhythm, flat line, and his circulatory system had shut down, so it was very difficult to get an IV into him. Finally, they did. And they tried emergency resuscitation drugs to get a heartbeat. They gave him atropine and epinephrine, which are both stimulants for the heart. Then they gave Narcan, which reverses the effects of opiates, just in case Greg had overdosed on one. Nothing worked. When they rolled his body over to slide him onto a backboard for transport to the hospital, they noticed the purple marks of lividity on his back and buttocks. So it looks like he'd been lying there for some time.
Longer than they thought.
Longer than they thought. Longer than was described to them by the grieving widow.
Right. And unlike they show in the movies, if there's a flat line, you can't defibrillate. No. If there's nothing there. You have to have some kind of a activity.
You have to have some electrical activity to be able to use the defibrillator.
Right.
That's right.
So that wasn't even a possibility.
Nope.
But yeah, the lividity would make them think that he'd been sitting that way for a while because blood had already pooled in the dependent areas.
Yep.
Another suspicious thing was there were no rose petals underneath his body or in the bed.
Yeah, so how did they get there if he was lying on the floor unconscious or dead?
Well, he was actually lying on the bed unconscious and she had to move him to the floor. So you'd think if he had rose petals on himself and she's pulling him onto the floor, at least a couple would have fallen on the bed.
Right, and there should be some underneath them.
Right. So it kind of looks like a setup situation already.
Yep.
So it was 10:03 p.m. when paramedics carried Greg down the stairs to the ambulance and they rushed him to Scripps Memorial Hospital. That was about 4 minutes away. One of the campus police officers followed with Kristen in his cruiser. The emergency room doctor tried again to save Greg, but he was way dead. Greg was officially declared dead at 10:19 after they'd done everything possible. And this was only 6 days before his 27th birthday. So definitely a tragedy. This is a young guy with everything to live for.
So it seems. Suicide wouldn't seem like an immediate consideration, would it?
No, because it seemed like he was happy. And he wasn't the type of person that was going to use drugs.
Right.
Plus, a lot of the circumstances didn't seem like it was something he had done.
Well, as soon as she got to the hospital, Kristen called her lover, Michael, and asked him to come and be with her.
Boy, that's really dumb.
Yep. And a couple of minutes later, she called her parents.
So she called her boss before her parents.
Yep.
That would make people wonder.
Her father answered the phone, and Ralph said he'd meet her at the hospital as quickly as he could. And then he handed the phone to his wife, Constance, and ran out to the car. Kristen spoke to her mother, explaining that Greg was in intensive care. Now, Michael Robertson arrived at the hospital about 15 minutes later. While they were in the waiting area together, he put his arm around her, comforted her, and held her hand. And the nurses thought he seemed like an extremely supportive boss.
Yeah, really. But Kristen was trying to downplay this to a lot of people she talked to, including her parents, saying he was in intensive care. She knew that he was dead.
Right.
Also, she had told some other people that he'd had an allergic reaction or taken the wrong medication. She was very hinky about the whole thing.
Yeah, well, here we go. We're going to be changing stories and stuff.
Yes.
Don't do that.
So at the hospital, Kristen was crying, but she was able to answer the ER nurse's questions about Greg's medical history and what drugs he might have taken. She said he might have used some old prescriptions that she had purchased in Tijuana 5 years earlier when she'd been trying to get off crystal meth. Then the nurse told her that they tried again to resuscitate her husband, but they weren't able to get him back. So Kristen's mom got a call at 10:49 p.m. from Michael, and he introduced himself as Kristen's boss, talking to her for about 10 minutes. Kristen's dad was on his way to meet them at the hospital, but her mother told Michael to just drive Kristen back to the apartment. After allowing the news of Greg's death to settle in, a social worker approached Kristen and asked her about tissue donation. Craig had decided to join Kristen as an organ and tissue donor just 2 weeks earlier when he'd renewed his driver's license. But because his heart had been stopped for a while, his organs couldn't be harvested. Still, some of his skin could be used to help burn victims. His corneas, veins, and heart valves could also be transplanted, as well as some of his bones. At 11:30 p.m., Kristen signed the paperwork to release those organs before returning home with Michael. So Michael took her back to the apartment.
He's a very solicitous boss, isn't he?
Very helpful.
So Detective Sergeant Bob Jones met Kristen and Michael on the landing in front of her apartment when they had returned from the hospital. So Michael stayed outside while Jones went in and interviewed Kristen. She told Jones that she had been fighting with Greg all weekend. It started on Thursday when she had told Greg she was moving out. They'd had dinner with his parents on Friday, spent Saturday night together, and then on Sunday night, Greg had taken some of her old prescriptions to help him sleep. And he'd been sleeping all day Monday, she said.
So that's very weird.
As she said, going on, that her work was only 15 minutes away, so she came home several times to check on him. And each time she'd found him sleeping, breathing, and he seemed fine. She told the police officer they'd had some soup together at lunchtime. And that's when he told her he'd taken some of her old oxycodone and clonazepam pills.
So oxycodone, we all pretty much know, is a narcotic painkiller. What about the other drug?
Well, it's also a narcotic and a sedative, also known as a date rape drug. So Kristen told Jones she'd run some errands after work and then came home to take a bath and a shower, which she did. And she was about to go to bed around 9 o'clock when she leaned over to kiss Greg, and his forehead felt cold. And she then realized he wasn't breathing, and she called 911 immediately. So here we are. This is a tough story to believe, I've got to tell you.
It is sketchy, isn't it?
So she comes home after running some errands. Presumably she checked on him and he was okay, so she decides to take a long bath and shower.
I think you'd be concerned if someone slept all night and then was sleeping all day and said he took some of your pills.
Mm-hmm.
I think you'd call 911 as soon as he'd been sleeping so long, right?
Yes.
Although she's trying to play it off like he was arousable, but it certainly sounds like he wasn't.
No.
So when she called 911, as I said, the dispatcher told her to pull him off of the bed so that he'd be flat on his back and she could do CPR. But oddly, Kristen was kind of hesitant to even do that. She said she didn't know if she was strong enough, but the dispatcher, of course, insisted that she move him. That's crucial.
Well, yeah.
So Kristen said she pulled back the covers to turn him sideways, and that's when she saw the rose petals all over his chest, as well as the wedding photo that he had. She said that was under his pillow.
Then Jones, the detective, also asked her about a shredded letter he had found in a plastic Ziploc bag on the dining room table. So Kristen said Greg had found it on a Thursday and got angry, so she put it through the shredder. But Greg had been trying to put it back together with tape. Jones took the letter as evidence, along with another note in Kristen's handwriting that one of his officers found in the kitchen. It was signed with a heart and Kristen's first initial. It read, "Hi, Sleepy. Hope you feel better. I'm out to get a wedding gift."
Well, he didn't take her diary. The detective didn't. But an officer had found it on the coffee table, so I don't know why he didn't.
Yeah.
Kristen's dad, Ralph, arrived at the apartment around midnight after stopping first at the hospital, where the social worker had told him that Greg had died. So he joined Kristen and the detective at the dining room table. Angie Wagner, an investigator colleague of Kristen's at the medical examiner's office, came by around 1 a.m. And by then, Kristen was sitting on the couch in the living room. Wagner didn't really know Kristen very well. In fact, she hadn't even known that Kristen was married. So that gives you an idea of how much she talked about her husband at work. But Wagner asked Kristen her own series of questions for her report. And after all the interviews were over, Michael finally left. He'd been there that whole time. And then Ralph helped Kristen into his car and took her back to Claremont, to his house. And this was about 1:40 a.m. when she finally left with her dad. And early on, the investigators really didn't see any reason not to believe Kristen's story. I mean, there were no signs of a struggle, and she'd been pretty upfront about the fact that they'd had a fight. Of course, they didn't know all about the drugs at work and her history, and they were going to find out a lot of stuff that would change their minds.
So when Greg's co-workers heard about his death, the idea of him dying from a drug overdose, even accidentally, just didn't make any sense. And Greg's brother Jerome felt the same way. Greg wasn't the kind of guy to do or take too much of anything, and he had no interest in taking any drugs. He wouldn't even take medication when he had a cold.
Right, so Jerome was kind of at the head of the fight to get this investigated as a homicide.
Yeah, he was really the impetus for this.
Right. He felt very strongly that his brother had been murdered.
Right. Meanwhile, Kristen's saying that Greg had committed suicide because he didn't want to live without her.
But which really makes her sound important, too, doesn't it?
It does.
But Greg's family was adamant that he wasn't suicidal. And on the morning of Greg's death, Monday, November 6th, they found out that Kristen made a series of calls from the cordless phone in the kitchen to Armando Garcia in Tijuana. So she made a call at 7:16, 7:17, and 7:33. Then at 7:42, she called Greg sick for work. But for unknown reasons, she didn't talk to anyone. She left a message on Greg's work voicemail. She later said she thought someone would hear it because Greg shared his phone number with another employee. But it's still, you know, a little strange.
It is. Now, she got to work that day later than usual, between 8 and 8:30. She looked tired and upset. Her co-workers saw her go into Michael's office and close the door right after the morning meeting. And she was in Michael's office for at least a half hour. And they could see through the glass pane in the door that she was crying. And as she said, she did leave the lab several times to go to her apartment. Just after noon, the maintenance man at the apartment complex saw Kristen drive into the parking lot faster than she should have in a residential area. She almost hit another car as she parked in front of the office. He saw her jump out and run toward her apartment. When she got back to work, she met with Michael again and left for the day around 2:30 in the afternoon.
So it certainly seems as if she knew something was going on at home.
Yes.
The next morning, Kristen gave investigators permission to re-enter the apartment so they could take another look around. And they went in with a video camera. They recorded the contents of each room, even though some of the items had been moved and others had been removed. Trying to corroborate Kristen's claim that she had some soup with Greg at lunchtime, they went out on the balcony and started digging through one of the trash bins, and they did see a soup can right on the top. When Michael was told that a private lab would be doing the toxicology testing on Greg, he had this momentary look of shock on his face, but then he did say he understood why that was the appropriate thing to do.
Well, yeah, I mean, they're going to be investigating one of their own employees. They can't do that. It's a definite conflict of interest.
Yeah, but it almost seems like they thought they were going to get away with that.
Yeah, I know.
And one thing that's notable, of course, is that their lab didn't test for fentanyl, which would turn out to be the drug that actually caused Greg's ultimate death, right?
Right. So he had a bruise near his elbow, measured 2 by 2.5 inches. With a needle mark in the middle of it. The artery had been punctured twice. There was another puncture wound on his right arm from the intravenous line and 2 needle marks on the left elbow from IV attempts by the paramedics.
Now, I wouldn't think you'd want to put the drugs in an artery. Wouldn't he have bled like crazy?
Yeah.
So maybe that was done at the hospital.
Sure, because you'd want an arterial line in.
Right, right.
So I don't think that has significance in terms of what Kristen might have done.
Right, I agree. The DeVillers family visited the Rossums in Claremont that morning, and they noticed that Kristen looked very skinny and that she had scabs on her face and arms. The two families sat down and talked about making arrangements for Greg's body and for a service. Kristen said she wanted to cremate Greg's body in the next few days. Marie was crying, of course, but she seemed okay with cremation. But she did say that Greg's father was coming to town and he might want to see Greg's body beforehand. But Kristen said she didn't want to put off on the cremation, so that made them a little suspicious.
Yeah.
Jerome thought that was really weird, and he right away sensed that Kristen wasn't telling them anything. Now remember, Jerome had some experience with Kristen from way back when she was stealing things from the apartment.
Yeah, he doesn't have a good relationship with her.
No. He doesn't trust her.
So he tried to get more information from Kristen, just basically in terms of what had happened. Kristen told him that Greg had been upset because she wouldn't stop seeing a past relationship and that he must have taken some medication. But when he asked her for details, Kristen would start crying, and she never did mention anything about the rose petals.
And at some point, Jerome would end up going in with a recorder trying to get her to confess something to him.
Yeah.
But she never did confess. Greg's family, co-workers, and friends didn't believe that he would have overdosed. So when investigators learned that Kristen and Michael's co-workers believed they were having an affair, of course they saw that as a motive for Greg's death being a homicide. But Michael continued to deny the affair. Greg's toxicology testing was done by an outside lab in Los Angeles. Then Kristen was fired from her job because she'd lied about her past and present drug use and because she was having an affair with Michael. Michael was also fired for hiding what he knew about her drug use and for having an affair with her. So Kristen was telling her friends that Greg's final gesture of covering himself with rose petals was a nod to her favorite movie, American Beauty. She said that Greg had given her 2 dozen red roses for her birthday, which was about 2 weeks before he died. She said she had thrown them away except for a few that were still in pretty good shape. But the rose petals that were on Greg seemed very fresh. Also, that dramatic gesture just didn't gel with detectives. It didn't seem like something that Greg or most guys would have done. Seemed a little too dramatic.
Circumstantial evidence is beginning to add up, looking like a homicide. Police confiscated 17 computers, including Michael Robertson's laptop. And the computers were turned over to the Regional Computer Forensic Laboratory in San Diego. So after nearly 1,000 hours of computer file examination, police started getting information showing communications between Kristen and Greg and Kristen and Michael. The search uncovered romantic messages between Kristen and Michael. They would write about spending their lives together and about their destiny.
Yeah, investigators found over 3 dozen files in Michael's computer also with documents pertaining to fentanyl, the drug which would be determined to have killed Greg. He also had a PowerPoint presentation that he'd saved that had talked about how some fentanyl patches had been missing from a medical examiner's office. Now, it's not that unusual that he had files on fentanyl. He works in a toxicology lab, so I don't know if that's the strongest evidence to me. But at the conference they'd attended together pretty recently, Kristen and Michael had learned a lot about fentanyl deaths.
Yeah, they got some good knowledge.
They did, so investigators had enough evidence to charge Kristen, but they didn't charge Michael. Kristen was arrested for Greg's murder, and Michael returned to Australia, so he was getting out of Dodge.
Well, he's going to save himself. I guess that their destiny wasn't meant to be.
It wasn't destined to be.
Yeah.
Right.
So Kristen's bail was set at $1.25 million, and she spent 6 months in jail before her parents were able to pay the bond. As the trial date approached, the prosecutors put together the timeline leading to Greg's death. So on November 5th, Kristen and Greg had a fight, which Kristen had admitted to. She said that Greg had given her an ultimatum after learning of her drug use and of her affair with her boss. And he said that either she quit her job or he would inform on her to the medical examiner's office.
So this, to me, I'm a little surprised that she admitted that. And if anything was going to make me think she wasn't guilty, it would probably be that she admitted that. But then on the other hand, I think, well, maybe her mind was just so drug-addled that she didn't realize how stupid she was being.
Probably that.
You think it's the latter?
Yeah.
Yeah. But another thing about the bail is her parents did pay that, but also there were fundraisers for her at her work, trying to raise money to get her bailed out. And a lot of people were like, what the fuck is this about? I mean, the parents had a $700,000 home, plus other investments and I think a second home. But they are trying to raise money from working people to bail out their daughter, who was kind of a shit anyway, and looks pretty damn guilty.
Yeah, and her co-workers really didn't like her.
Most of them didn't. I mean, there were some that had fallen for the whole idea that she was a good person and all that. And some people did give money, but there were other people that thought this is just ridiculous and didn't want anything to do with giving money to wealthy people for their murdering daughter. Didn't go over that well with most of her co-workers.
Yeah, I can imagine. So prosecutors further believe that on November 6th, Kristen drugged Greg and called his job to say he wouldn't be in.
Sure.
So we're setting up the alibi, right?
Yeah.
He was lying in bed all day, but did not answer the phone, which was right at the bedside. Now, Kristen claimed that he was awake and ate with her at lunchtime, but no one answered the phone at their apartment.
Right. So why would that be?
It's tough to reconcile those two.
Yes.
Kristen claimed that Greg told her he had taken some of her oxycodone and Klonopin. That's the clonazepam.
Mm-hmm.
But prosecutors believe she gave the drugs to him without his knowledge.
In the soup, perhaps?
If he was awake
for
the soup.
Although he had to be drugged before the soup.
Right.
So, but I feel like she was drugging him early that day. So he was almost in a coma, right?
Right.
So once he's in a coma, she basically overdosed him with the fentanyl. We're not sure if she did that orally or how she did it.
Well, if he was comatose, she couldn't have done it orally. Not very well.
Well, you could just take a syringe full. I mean, it's super strong.
Yeah, might be difficult. Anyway, that's what he died from.
Yes.
Then the 911 call was scrutinized. Kristen was supposed to be doing CPR, but she never apparently put down the phone and certainly wasn't out of breath. And the paramedics arrived within 3 minutes of her call. Kristen was in the other room, at least 20 feet from Greg's body.
Yeah, I would take that much more seriously than not sounding like she's doing CPR, because that's, you can't totally tell. But if she's in a whole other room when the paramedics come, I mean, to me, that's crazy. That's just damn crazy, isn't it?
It is.
I mean, if you've got your husband on the floor, you leave the room on the phone when you're supposed to be doing CPR. I mean, and she has some education in chemistry and in the medical field. So she knows that he needs to be getting oxygen to be salvageable.
Well, she has to know that.
She has to know that. So she's just leaving him there to die, basically.
Yeah. And besides the fact that she was at some distance from his body, there was no redness or bruising or anything on his chest that could result from chest compressions.
Right. So she hadn't even bothered to do that.
She hadn't.
No. Her story was that when she pulled back the bed covers to move him off the bed, there were the rose petals and they went everywhere. But like I said earlier, there were none on the bed and none beneath his body when they lifted him up. Plus, there were the signs that he'd been dead for at least 2 hours. Just days before jury selection for Kristen's trial, prosecutors got a new piece of evidence to use against her. She had a Vons discount card in her wallet when she was arrested, and this store, Vons, keeps a record of purchases when you use that card. So they found a transaction that she made on the afternoon that Greg died. At 12:41 p.m., she bought chicken soup, cold medication, and a single rose. So it showed that she'd bought a rose, which was probably what was used in his death scene.
Probably. And the interesting thing about this Vons discount card
yeah.
is that she was set to pay cash or something.
She paid cash. So.
But then she got the discount, so she used the card to save 50 cents or something.
Right. And that's what did her in.
Yeah. Smart.
Yeah.
So the trial lasted about a month, and there were over 50 witnesses called. Kristen testified in her own defense. Maybe not the best move. And she was caught in several lies. The verdict came in on Greg's 29th birthday. Kristen was found guilty of first-degree murder and sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole.
And I think she was pretty shocked because she thought she was really coming across well. She was out on bail, and her parents would drive her in for the trial, and she'd be dressed with pearls, and she looked very prim and proper. But then when you'd look at her mugshot when they arrested her, totally different. She looked like a meth addict. So Michael Robertson was called an unindicted co-conspirator and remained under investigation. In 2006, prosecutors did file a criminal complaint, charging him with one count of conspiracy to obstruct justice. So he could have faced up to 3 years in prison if he returned to the U.S., but he didn't do that.
I don't think he'll be arriving in the U.S. anytime soon.
No.
And Kristen Rossum's appeals have been denied. Both she and San Diego County were found responsible for Greg's death in a wrongful death lawsuit. Kristen was ordered to pay over $100 million in punitive damages, and the county was ordered to pay $1.5 million.
Yeah, but they're really not going to see any money from her, not much.
No. And the county was liable because the way they handled the 911 call?
No, the county where she worked, the medical examiner's office.
Gotcha.
Yeah, because the guy who was running things knew she was taking drugs and was having an affair with her and all that jazz. Plus not testing her for drugs or checking her background. There's a lot of things.
Okay.
Yeah. So if you want to find out more about this case, there is a series of articles on this case in the LA Times archives, which I found really good. There's also a book available on Kindle titled Poisoned Love by Caitlin Rother. There's another book by John Glatt as well titled Deadly American Beauty. There's a 48 Hours episode, American Beauty, from 2002. So there's quite a bit out there if you're interested. Although I think we covered it pretty damn well.
I think we did.
Okay. Well, thank you to Tristan Capel for writing and producing the music for TCB. Team Tie Grabber is still on hold this week, but we had a very productive meeting with our website designer yesterday. So we're really excited about the positive changes coming for our website and for our membership. The website's going to be a lot easier to use, and membership will be instant, and I can't wait to create some new content, maybe even some video dip. What do you think?
I'm up for it.
But if you do have a few minutes to spare, we would greatly appreciate it if you could leave us a review on iTunes or wherever it is that you listen. More positive reviews help people to find our podcast, which is a good thing. So I think we should move on to feedback. If you'd like your voicemail played on a future show, you can just go to our website, tiegrabber.com, and click on Leave a Voicemail. We would love to hear your comments on cases we've covered or suggestions for cases that you think we should cover. Alternately, you can send us an email to truecrimebrewery@tiegrabber.com or send us a message on Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter. Another thing a lot of people have been doing lately, and I appreciate it, is joining our True Crime Brewery fan discussions page on Facebook. That's a place where you can chat with other listeners about past cases, case suggestions, and even share current news in the true crime genre. Dick checks on that at least every 2 or 3 days, right?
Right.
And you give some comments, so Dick's always a fun guy to talk to.
Well, I think I found out about one of our old cases involving the football coach murdering his wife.
Oh yeah, share that.
Temple.
David Temple.
Right. He's been granted a new trial.
And why is that?
There was apparently some misconduct on the part of the prosecution.
Our girl Kelly?
Kelly Siegler didn't divulge everything she should have divulged to the defense attorney. So they've granted a new trial, and it's going to take place or start on the 8th of July. And we will follow that and see what the results are.
Oh, yeah. I think we should follow up with that on the Facebook page, or even on a future show.
Right.
Yeah. That was one of our most popular cases. And then all the weird connections to Katy, Texas. It's almost like Kevin Bacon.
Yes.
Yeah. There's all these connections. So that's interesting. Although we feel like he's guilty. I do.
Oh, there's absolutely no question in my mind.
Right. Okay. So what do we have for feedback today?
Well, we have some voicemails and some emails. The first voicemail is from Caitlin. It's a comment for us.
Hi, Jill and Dick. This is Caitlin. I'm a rheumatologist in Columbus, Ohio, and my sister introduced me to your guys' podcast about a month and a half ago, and I've been really enjoying it and listen to it just about every morning as I get ready for work and drive to work and come home. And this morning I heard one of the listeners talking about Dr. William Husel and his case here in Columbus. And I just want to give you a little bit of insight about what it was like to work with Dr. Husel, because I worked with him in the ICU at Mount Carmel West. So I don't know if he's innocent or guilty, and honestly, we'll kind of just see what the court says on that. But working with him, I've always thought he was a really nice guy, very professional. I think he took excellent care of thousands and thousands of patients that came in and out of the ICU in those 4 years that he was at West. And he was always like ready to help us residents when we were in the ICU or struggling with anything. So he didn't have to help us. He wasn't obligated to. He had his own patients and then we had ours. But in the middle of the night, I could go to him if I was having trouble with intubating a patient, getting a central line, getting an arterial line going. And he would even like check in on our patients just to make sure that they were doing well and that we were doing the things that we needed to do. So I thought he really helped me along. These were all people that made it out of the ICU and did great. So I was always happy to have his help, and I felt like I could go to him for anything when there were a lot of other people I didn't feel like I could go to. So I just want to give you that insight. We'll see how his trial goes, and thank you so much for your podcast. I really enjoy listening to you guys, and have a great week this week. Thanks. Bye.
Thank you, Caitlin. So can you remind me about this? I don't remember it.
So this was a case that somebody thought would be interesting. This is an intensivist doctor in Ohio who's accused of overdosing patients on fentanyl.
Oh, wow. Wow.
Causing their death. And there's a large number of deaths that he's been implicated in.
Yeah, I remember that now.
As long as well as nurses and pharmacists that have been suspended without pay or otherwise disciplined.
Oh, sure. This was just last week we talked about this.
Very, very recent.
Okay.
So I know we want to do this case. And I just thought it was a nice comment.
Yeah, it's interesting to have someone say something positive about him.
Right.
Because it's always easy to just go along with what a bad person someone was. But as we know, people have many different aspects to their personality and to what they do. And I mean, he could have been a nice guy and been innocent. He could have been a nice guy and been guilty. You know, it's just the way it works.
Right.
But I think that's great insight. So thanks a lot, Caitlin. I appreciate that.
And then we have a lot of letters, a lot of voicemails from Anne. She gave us a 6-part message.
Okay.
So I'm going to play parts 1 and 2 that have a comment and a case suggestion for those 2 parts. But those are the ones we're going to play.
Okay, so she just ran out of time and had like a 15-minute message?
Right. They're all 2 and 3/4, 3 minutes in length.
Yeah, because we have a 3-minute limit.
Well, there's 6 of them.
Because actually on this app, you have to pay more depending on how much of a limit you want. And we used to have a 1-minute limit. I paid a little more to get the 3-minute limit. And most people do it in 3 minutes, but I guess Annie had a lot to say, so I'm going to play part 1 right now.
Play part 1. This is going to be mostly a comment in the beginning, I think, of the case suggestion, and then the 2nd one will be more of the case suggestion.
Great.
Hi, Jill and Dick. This is Anne. I'm a big fan of the podcast. Like everyone who calls in, I love the way that the two of you discuss the crimes with each other. I'm incredibly impressed with the effort and the research and the work that goes in behind the scenes. It's very obvious to those of us who love listening to y'all. So thank you again for putting out such a quality podcast. And it's brought a lot of, well, I don't want to say comfort because we're talking about crime and violent crimes. But I enjoy your company, I should say. Y'all keep me company frequently when I'm doing work around the house. And I just really enjoy listening to you. I do have a case suggestion. But first, I wanted to just make a comment. Your recent episode, I've blocked the guy's name because he's so horrible. The man who, you know, is a serial child rapist and murderer that you just covered not too long ago. I had a really tough time with that one. I usually don't listen to those crimes on any of the podcasts that I listen to that feature true crime. I just have a really hard time as a mom of a young child. I just can't do it. So anyway, I broke my own rule and listened to this episode, and I'm glad I did because it was really interesting, and I felt like y'all gave us a lot of good kind of tips and advice about protecting our children. And unfortunately, I do think you're right that they just have to be supervised at all times as much as possible. So with that in mind, I would really appreciate some specific advice, probably from Dick as a pediatrician. I'd like to know, what are the kinds of things that we should be saying to our kids and asking them? I'm always really try to make an effort to tell my daughter that her body is hers, that it belongs to her, and that if anyone ever touches her or wants to do anything to her that she doesn't like, that it is her right to say no, to scream, to yell, to run away. But it's tough because it's like she doesn't want to pay attention to me. It looks like I'm running out of time, so I'm going to call back with my case suggestion. And so that's that.
Did you want to answer her question before we go to the next one?
Sure, because okay. It's not a very long answer. We all know kind of what we need to talk to our kids about.
Yeah, but it's difficult because you don't want to overdo it and scare them.
No.
No, but you want them to feel empowered, so.
Well, and I think the way to be doing that is to, first of all, be age appropriate. Keep it simple. Kind of the less information, the better, to still get your point across. And you got to repeat it. I mean, not every single day.
But no, but sitting down and having the talk about it is not enough.
No, you got to do something to be able to revisit the topic.
Sure.
And again, like you said, You got to do this in a way that the child doesn't feel is a threatening way or gets too bored from it.
And I think one thing we said on that episode is use the appropriate body part names. Why is that important? Even as a young kid, well, you don't want to say ding dong and all that.
It's important. You need to have the appropriate language, appropriate terminology. But it's also, again, we're talking about keeping it simple. Name the thing. Don't use a euphemism for it.
Sure. So that you're clear.
Right.
That wasn't a lot of advice, Dick, but I guess there's only so much you can do.
I don't think there's a lot of advice except that you need to be able to be open with your child and have these discussions.
Well, what about her saying that her daughter doesn't really want to listen? I mean, that's a kid for you, right?
Yeah.
How do you make sure they're hearing you?
Keep it brief.
So maybe frequent short talks instead of one long talk?
Oh, sure. If I'm sitting down and I'm going to be, as a kid, listening to my parents again talk about the stuff they talked about last week, I'll be bored.
Which boredom isn't the worst thing that can happen, though, as long as they hear you.
Right.
Okay, I'm going to play part two now.
Okay, this is the case suggestion.
Okay.
So on to my case suggestion. I am originally from Birmingham, Alabama. I grew up in the 80s and early 90s and then went off to college mid-90s. When I left college, I got a job as a special ed aide in the Mountain Brook school systems, which is actually the school system that I grew up in. So this is a little city outside of Birmingham, and it's a very, like, lovely, kind of idyllic, upper middle class, affluent area. I worked with a woman named Beth Twitty, who was the speech pathologist, I mean, the speech therapist, who worked with the young kids who had some speech and developmental delays in our little classroom that I worked in. And she was just the loveliest, sweetest, kindest, most gentle person. I was so drawn to her. And I met her daughter the very next year when I followed the little boy that I was working with as he moved on to junior high. Her daughter, Natalie Holloway, was a junior high student, and she would come and volunteer from time to time in the special ed classroom. And she was just a lovely, sweet, great student, cute girl. Just, I'm about to run out of time again. Oh my God.
Okay. So she's recommending the Natalie Holloway
case. So you get the essentials. And Anne goes on in the next few messages to just discuss the case.
Okay. She has some insights.
I don't think there are any new insights. I think it's tempered by her being friends with Natalie and her mother.
So just kind of attesting to the type of people they were. And
right.
Okay.
From listening to Anne, I don't think there's any disagreement with the suspected murderer.
No. No. No, I mean, that is a multifaceted case, so there would definitely be a lot to talk about. I think it's something that we did consider. We actually own a couple of books about it, but we kind of turned away from it because it's just so publicized. But it's certainly something we could definitely get back to at some point.
Yeah, I think I would agree totally with you there, that there's just so much stuff written about it, and I don't know that we could do anything to improve on that.
Right. That's the thing. I don't think we have anything to add that most people wouldn't already know.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, thanks, Anne. Thanks for all of your comments and for your case recommendation.
Yeah, keep them coming.
Be careful what you ask for, Dick.
I know. I mean, they were great to listen to.
Yeah. Yeah.
And if we had time, I'd play the other four. That'd be another 10, 12 minutes.
Hey, on a slow week, we might play another one of them or two.
Who knows?
Yeah, depends how many voicemails we have.
Now, we got a couple emails.
All right.
And the first one is from Sharon, and she has a case suggestion.
And she writes, I'm writing to you including a link regarding a recent murder trial in Ireland, which is currently approaching sentencing and conclusion. It's an incredibly sad and shocking story affecting people throughout the country. Everyone knows the case. And mainly, I said I'd send it on to you guys out of pure interest. I know you've covered one or two Irish cases in the past, so I said I'd send you on the information regarding this case. Thank you so much for continuing to work so hard on your show. It's entertaining, if sometimes harrowing, to listen to and a definite, not so guilty, guilty pleasure of mine. Thank you. That's a nice little email.
It is. So the link was to an article about a young girl named Anna Kriegel. And she was murdered when she was 14 years old. She was a child adopted from Russia and had some medical issues and was bullied at school and just didn't sound like a great life for her. And the people that are accused of murdering her are two 14-year-old boys. One was apparently the kid who lured her to the house where the other kid was waiting for her. So, interesting looking case. I think we should check into that.
All right. That sounds like a harrowing case, to use her word.
It does.
Yeah. Okay, we have another email from Patricia.
Yeah, she has a case suggestion. Patricia says, love your podcast. Do you know the case of Michelle Young? The second of two trials is beginning to take place, and there's also a book called Murder on Birchleaf Drive. I would love to hear your take, how not speaking to cops, your rule, I know, almost got this bastard off. Creepy but interesting case.
Well, that's funny, because I think I just bought that book on Kindle last week.
Did you?
You know how I go through Kindle books and say, oh, here's a crime. I'm always looking for something I've never heard of, because I don't want to rehash crimes that all the other podcasts are doing.
Right. Well, this looks interesting.
It did look interesting. That's why I bought the book.
A husband of a pregnant woman who was found beaten to death 5 years ago was back in court in readiness for a second trial.
Yep. So Jason Young, 37, faces first-degree murder charges in connection with the 2006 death of his wife, Michelle Young, in their Raleigh, North Carolina home. Michelle Young was 5 months pregnant with their second child at the time of her death. So why is he back in court? Why is he getting a new trial?
I believe the first trial resulted in a hung jury.
He'd been behind bars since 2009, released from jail in 2011, and now could face life in prison without the possibility of parole if convicted. So she compared this to the Brad Cooper trial. Or is that just because they're both been televised?
Probably.
Okay.
But it'd be good to check out.
Yeah. Well, we have the book, so we probably will be doing it soon.
Okay. Thanks, Patricia.
Yeah. Thank you, Patricia. Thank you to everyone who wrote in and who called and left a voicemail to us. We really appreciate your feedback.
We certainly do. I had a good number of things to choose from this week.
You did. And just a word to some people who sent voicemails that were just complimentary and making some nice comments to us. We didn't play them because we don't feel like other listeners are that interested, but we are definitely flattered and happy to hear from you.
Right. And there are some other voicemails with case suggestions that I think I'm saving for now.
Oh, okay.
So you might hear your voicemail in the next couple of weeks.
Great. We did get a good amount. I mean, thanks to Anne, we got a lot. But even without Anne's 6 voicemails, we did get a good amount this week.
We had about half a dozen without Anne.
That's wonderful.
So
yeah, that's
great. So there are some good suggestions.
Absolutely. Well, thanks a lot, everyone. I hope everyone's doing well, and we'll see you next week.
At the quiet end.
At the quiet end. Bye-bye.
Bye.